This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, July 4th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, we spend the half hour with author, linguist, historian, and activist Noam Chomsky.
We're the ones who know how to run the place, so let's run it and kick out the bosses. You know, that's only one step away.
We'll look at the labor movement, sit-down strikes, and worker-run collectives.
You know, it sounds reformist, but it's revolutionary.
We'll explore the impact of the ruling elite, propaganda, and the commercial media.
It's a distorting prism with enormous impact.
All that and more coming up on today's special program from Free Speech Radio News. Stay with us. Noam Chomsky is well known for a lot of things, from his extensive and pivotal contributions to the field of linguistics to launching and maintaining a critical global discussion about propaganda in mass media. He's authored more than 100 books, has been presented with dozens of honorary degrees and awards, and has taught at MIT for 58 years. Professor Chomsky recently invited FSRN to his office in Cambridge for an extended interview conducted by our producer, Catherine Comp. On today's program, we bring you most of that interview. Find out how you can get a DVD of the full discussion and support FSRN at our website, fsrn.org. And now to the interview.
Professor Chomsky, thanks for inviting Free Speech Radio News to Cambridge.
Very glad to be with you.
The mainstream media rarely mentions people-driven solutions to the world's problems, so we'd like to talk to you about just that today. Let's start with the labor movement. You've talked about the effectiveness of sit-down strikes, in which workers occupy a workplace as a precursor to taking it over. And you've said with enough popular support, sit-down strikes can work and be the basis for a real revolution. But how much popular support is needed, and what should it look like?
Well, it has to be extensive. Actually, it can work. I happened to just come back from Ireland. And one of the things I did there was meet with a group of workers, a plant called the Vita Cortex plant. I'd been supporting their strike. They had a long sit-down strike. The management wanted to sell the plant, a profitable plant, sell it to some rich entrepreneur who'd move it somewhere else. And they were just going to be all fired. Some of them had long tenure, you know. And they just decided, they got together, formed a community support group, and sat in on the plant. It was community support considerable. The people wanted to keep them there. People brought food, you know. And all kind of help, and they won. After, I think, about 6 months, the owner agreed to keep it there, pay the workers, and so on.
That was in Ireland?
That was in Cork. And it was doing okay, you know, not hugely profitable. And in Ireland's in a big downturn, so this was serious, you know. But they won. They didn't get everything, but a lot. And it can be done, but it... You know, a lot of the New Deal legislation, which was important, a lot of it was motivated by concerns, employer and other concerns, when CIO organizing, which was new then, reached the point where it was leading to sit-down strikes. Well, because sit-down strikes strike fear into management and everyone else. If we're sitting in and doing nothing, why shouldn't we? We're the ones who know how to run the place, so let's run it and kick out the bosses. You know, that's only one step away.
Why are they so rare in the United States?
Well, first of all, labor actions are very rare. Strikes or any kind of strike is very rare. There's been especially since Reagan, who kind of broke the ban against using scabs. That's outlawed everywhere in the world. I think maybe South Africa still allowed it. But when Reagan broke the flight controller strike, and then he set the tone, and a few years later, maybe 10 years later, there was a strike in a major a Caterpillar plant, a manufacturing plant, I think it was in Peoria, and the management broke it by bringing in scabs. Now that's illegal everywhere in the world. As I say, apartheid South Africa, I think, allowed it. But it passed, it wasn't overlooked. And it's kind of interesting what happened. It's Peoria, so the Chicago Tribune, which is a conservative newspaper, but it covered labor affairs pretty well. They had a lot of coverage of it and the scandal of bringing in scabs. Well, that was maybe 20 years ago. When President Obama, who was in Chicago at the time, so he couldn't have missed it, when he decided to show his solidarity with workers, he went to that plant and nobody commented on it. It's effaced from memory. And the labor movement, as you know, has been decimated. It developed enormously in the 1930s and is responsible for most of the progressive legislation that took place. There was an immediate backlash, even by the late 30s. That's when management initiated what are now called scientific methods of strike breaking, you know, sophisticated strike breaking techniques.
What are some of those?
Well, some of them were called the Mohawk Valley formula. The idea is you take, say, there's some town in Pennsylvania where there's a strike going on. You saturate the town with propaganda about how the basic theme is Americanism. We're all Americans. We all work together. We all love each other. We're all helping the friendly boss who works 80 hours a day to the bone for the service of the workers, the banker who loves to give you money to buy your car, and the workman with his pail going to work, and his wife who's making dinner at home, and they're all one big happy family living in harmony. And then these outsiders come in, the union organizers, and this kind of hint is, well, they're probably communists, you know, bad word. And they come in, they're trying to disrupt our harmony and prevent us from living our good American dream, the way we all live together. Now that's basically the theme. That's saturated with propaganda, you know, the schools, the churches, everything. And it sometimes has an effect. That's one technique. There are others. These, again, developed substantially under Reagan, who was very anti-labor. But in fact, he hated poor people altogether with a passion. So, for example, during the lettuce strike, you remember the farm workers' strike, there was a boycott. And I think Reagan must have been governor of California that during the lettuce boycott, he very ostentatiously appeared, you know, on television, happily eating lettuce, just to show what he thought about these, the poorest of the poor. You know, if you can kick them in the face, great. You know, he loved that. And in fact, illegal firing of union organizers, illegal firing, it went way up during the Reagan years. I think may have tripled. And it continued. Then you come along with Clinton, and he had a different technique of undermining unions. It was called NAFTA. There have been studies under the NAFTA rules, actually, of the effect of NAFTA on strike breaking in the United States. And it's substantial. It's illegal, but if you have a criminal state, you can do what you like. They don't enforce the laws. So a standard technique would be, say, if there's a organizing campaign somewhere for a management to put up signs saying transfer job to Mexico, you know, and the workers are kind of a captive audience, so management's allowed to talk to them. And the line is, okay, you guys can go and strike if you want, but if you win, it's all going to Mexico. So that's a very effective technique. In the absence of solidarity, real solidarity, in fact, international solidarity, it's a pretty effective technique of strike breaking. And the number of illegal strike breaking efforts, I think, went up by about 50% after NAFTA. And then there are other devices. But now This started right after the Second World War with Taft-Hartley, huge anti-labor campaigns and so on. And there are now companies which just do strike breaking. They're scientific strike breaking, all kind of sophisticated techniques. And there's plenty of clout behind it, you know, huge amount of corporate money, and the government supports it. So
one solution, since labor has been weakened, is for workers to start their own worker-run and managed businesses. A lot of people were inspired by the growth of worker-run collectives and businesses in Argentina following the 2001 economic collapse there. In the United States, there's about several hundred, including Free Speech Radio News, which has been worker-run and worker-managed since it was founded 13 years ago. Do you think this could grow and expand in the United States?
It's quite significant. Actually, the most interesting cases, there's been very good work on this by Gar Alperovitz, which ought to be read, who's both an activist and a writer, a very good historian. It's mostly, what I know of is mostly around northern Ohio and the Rust Belt. And what happened there is interesting. And we're thinking about in 1977, U.S. Steel decided to, you know, huge conglomerate, decided to close down the steel plants in Youngstown. Youngstown's a steel town. You know, it was built, they say, by the company, meaning built by the workforce. That's created the economy, kept it alive, you know, created the communities, and brought in income from, you know, fairly decent wages for steel workers, and still back to the old days. But the company decided to, the corporation decided to close it. Well, instead of just walking off, the union organized and offered to buy the plant. And they had a lot of community support. The company refused. It finally went to the courts. It's interesting that the companies would rather lose money and close the plant rather than have workers take it over and run it. Now, they're class conscious. They're not stupid. This happens a lot, in fact. So went to court. The workers had Staunton Lind led the legal team that fought for the workers. They lost in court, but with public support, they could have won. There wasn't a lot of public support, except locally. You know, the local community supported it, but not, should have been nationally or internationally, you know, then they would have probably won. Okay, they didn't give up. And it was going to destroy the town, but instead they started turning to just what you described, originally small, local, worker-run or cooperative enterprises. And they spread around Cleveland quite in a way that made a lot of sense. There's a lot of public institutions in Cleveland, you know, hospitals, universities, and so on, and they need services. So they started running big cooperative worker-owned laundries, things like that. And they're working out pretty well, and then they started spreading, and by now there's a substantial network. And it's the kind of thing that could be done right here in Boston. Was a case not long ago, right, a little before the time of Occupy, where one of the suburbs of Boston, there was a plant that was producing specialized airplane parts. And it was doing okay, but the multinational, what happens very often is an enterprise may be doing reasonably well, you know, profitable, but an multinational may not want to keep it on their books, because it's not making enough profit, and they can make higher profits by using the fund somewhere else, you know, speculating or whatever it is. So the multinational decided to close the plant. The workers, again, like Youngstown, the union offered to buy the plant, the workers in the plant. The company refused, and unfortunately there wasn't much support, and it closed. But if, say, the Occupy movement had been alive at the time and had picked this up, they could have mobilized support.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Dorian Marina. Today, we're bringing you our extended interview with Professor Noam Chomsky, conducted in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Find out how you can get a DVD of the full interview and support independent grassroots radio journalism by going to our website, fsrn.org.
It's been 25 years since the publication of your and Edward Herman's acclaimed book, Manufacturing Consent. How much do you think has changed with the propaganda model, and where do you see it playing out most prominently today?
Well, actually, about 10 years ago, we had a reedition, and we talked about some of the changes. One change is that we were too narrow. One of the filters we talked about, you know, it's a number of filters that determine the framework of reporting. And one of the filters was anti-communism. Now, that was too narrow. It should have been fear of the concocted enemy. So, yes, it could be anti-communism. Most of that is concocted. So take Cuba again. It's hard to believe, but Cuba was for the Pentagon, Cuba was listed as one of the threats to the United States until a couple of years ago, a military threat. I mean, this is so ludicrous. You don't even know whether to laugh or cry. It's as if the Soviet Union had listed Luxembourg as a threat to its security. But here it kind of passes. It's a very frightened country. So it's, and there's all kind of things concocted for you to be frightened about. That should have been the filter. But and a few other things, but basically I think it's the same. I mean, there's a change in the fact that in things like this, so Free Speech Radio didn't exist when we wrote, and other, there are some things on the internet which break the bonds, do independent work. There are things like the book that I was just talking about when we came in, Jeremy Scales, Dirty Wars, which is a fantastic piece of investigative reporting on the ground of what actually happens in the countries where we're carrying out these terror campaigns. There's a lot of talk about drones, but not much about the fact that they're terror weapons. If we were sitting here wondering if all of a sudden there's going to be a bomb in this room, which is because they want to kill him, and maybe it'll kill us or whatever. Well, yeah, it's terrorizing. In fact, we just saw a dramatic example of this, which got a couple of lines in the paper. A few days after the Boston Marathon bombing, there was a drone attack on a village in Yemen, kind of isolated village. Obama and his friends decided to murder some guy. So the villagers are sitting there, and suddenly this guy gets blown away, and whoever else is around him. I don't think it was reported, except for the fact that there was Senate testimony a week later by a person from the village, who's quite respected by Jeremy and others who knew him. He testified to the Senate, and he described what happened in his village. He said that the man who they murdered was, everybody knew him, they could have easily apprehended him, but easier to kill him. And terrified the village. And he also said something else, which is important. He said that for years, the radical jihadi elements had been trying to get the villagers to hate America, and they'd failed, because what these villagers knew about America was basically what he was telling them, young men, and he loved America, it was wonderful. He said the one bomb has turned them into people who hate America and want revenge. That's all it takes. And in fact, this whole terror system is creating enemies and threats faster than it's killing suspects, apart from how awful that is. Well, anyway, these things are going on. And a book, going back to Jeremy, his book exposes a lot of it, also the exploits of the secret executive army, JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, a lot of things that reporters could do, He's a reporter, after all, and he did it. It's dangerous, you know, but it's the kind of thing an investigative reporter could do. There's more of it now, fortunately, in some respects, than there was then.
So some progress.
So, yes, on the other hand, the indoctrination system has gotten incredibly powerful. So I'd say it's about the same.
Income inequality entered the national dialogue with the Occupy movement, but the wealth gap for Black and Latino families rarely generates debate or headlines. What role should media, particularly independent media, play in ensuring critical public interest issues like these are at the forefront?
Well, independent media ought to be telling the truth about things that matter. That's quite different from the task of the commercial media. They have a task. They're supposed to be objective. And objectivity has a meaning in the world of journalism. In fact, it's taught in journalism schools. Objectivity means reporting honestly and accurately what's going on within the beltway, you know, inside the government. So that sets the bounds. There's Democrats, there's Republicans, report honestly what they're saying, you know, balanced and so on. That's then your objective. If you go beyond that, you ask a question about the bounds, then you're biased, subjective, emotional, maybe anti-American, or whatever the usual curse words are. So that's a task, and you can understand it from the point of view of established power. But of course, it leads to an extraordinary, it's a distorting prism with enormous impact, even just the framework of what's looked at. I mean, take, for example, the current domestic issues. We have a sequester, which is harming the economy, of course. It's, in fact, conceded. But what's it about? Well, it's about the deficit. Now, who cares about the deficit? Banks, rich people, and so on. What does the population care about? Jobs. In fact, this has even been studied. So there's a couple of professional studies which just tested this question. It turns out concern about the deficit increases with wealth. And the reason is, rich people are concerned that maybe someday in the future there might be a little bit of inflation, which is not good for lenders. It's fine for borrowers. But so therefore, we have to worry about the deficit, even if it destroys jobs. The population has quite different views. They say, no, we want jobs. And they're right. Jobs means stimulating demand. Government's got to do that. Corporations have money coming out of their ears, but they're not investing it because there's no demand. Consumers can't fill the gap because they're suffering the impact of the crimes that the banks carried out. Of course, they were richer than ever. That's the way it works. But and that's essentially what the population wants, but it's not what's discussed within the Beltway. And so you get some little comment on it around the fringes, but the focus has to be on the terrible problem of the deficit, which is maybe a problem someday in the future, but not very serious. And going back to your point, what the independent press ought to be doing is what the press ought to be doing, looking at the world from the point of view of its population. And this holds on issue after issue, and almost pick it at random.
The Occupy movement has had several pretty big successes: Occupy Sandy, Occupy Our Homes, Strike Debt, and the Rolling Jubilee. But what do you think a post-Occupy movement looks like? What comes next?
The Occupy tactic was a remarkably successful tactic. I mean, if I'd been asked a month before in Zuccotti Park whether to do this, I would have said, you're crazy. But it worked extremely well, just lighted a fire all over the place. There was obviously plenty of, just people were just waiting for something to light the spark. And it was extremely successful. But it's a tactic. And tactics are not strategies. A tactic has a half-life, you know. It has diminishing returns. And in particular, a tactic like this is going to arouse antagonism because people don't want their lives disrupted and so on. It'll be easy to fan it, you know, the way you do with public workers. So it's a tactic that had to be revised. Frankly, when the police broke the occupations up, it was harsh and brutal. It didn't have to be done like that. But in some ways, it wasn't a bad thing because it turned people to what they have to do next. And what they have to do next is bring it to the general population, neighborhood actions, things like what you mentioned, take up topics that really bother people, be there when you're needed, like Sandy, be there for the foreclosures. These are all things that, you know, the focus on debt, focus on financial transaction tax, which ought to be instituted. Nobody else is bringing it up, and that's what the Occupy movement will be doing. It will become a national, in fact, international movement. It's actually striking that there are Occupies offshoots all over the world. I've talked at Occupy movements in Sydney, Australia, and England, you know, all over. And everywhere you go, there's something. And they link with other things that are happening, like the Indignados in Spain, the student actions in Chile, which are pretty remarkable, you know, things in Greece, which are enormous, and even moves in the peripheral parts of Europe to organize the countries and struggle against the brutal austerity regimes, which are worse than here. I mean, we look progressive in comparison with Europe, and which are just strangling the economies and destroying the European social contract. In fact, that's the only plausible explanation of what they're up to. But that's a future that can be looked forward to. And things like what we were talking about before, supporting and maybe even initiating things like worker-owned, worker-managed enterprises. That's, you know, it sounds reformist, but it's revolutionary. That's changing, at least giving the germs for changing the basic structure of the society in a fundamental way.
And that's all for today's program. FSRN's interview with Professor Noam Chomsky was recorded on May 3rd, 2013 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Today's program was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks to Jessel Noor, Chuck Rosina, and Shakil Ahmad for recording this interview. Janine Etter is today's technical producer. Special thanks to Bev Stahl, Greg Ruggiero, and Tim Russo. Today's interview will be included in the forthcoming second edition of Noam Chomsky's Occupy book, due out this fall. You can obtain a copy of the first edition and a DVD of FSRN's full interview with Professor Chomsky by going to our website, fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.